Radio Catskill.
Live from the Radio Catskill studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, with Tropical Storm Erin forecast to strengthen into the first Atlantic hurricane of 2025 this week and flooding risks rising across the Northeast, Sullivan County officials now say the time is now to review your safety plan and know exactly what to do when that alert hits your phone. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett speaks to local officials about how to prepare for heavier rains and potential flooding. It's Woodstock week. Today, step back behind the music and the mud. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar explores the quirky Bindi Bazaar, the countercultural crafts hub of the original Woodstock. Plus, the Lackawaxen River Trails have something for everyone. And this weekend and next, Franklin Stage Company brings Red, the play, to life. We'll learn more after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin will hold a joint press conference after they meet in Anchorage, Alaska tomorrow. The two are holding talks on ending Russia's war with Ukraine. Trump says the meeting will set the table for real progress toward peace. President Trump's federal takeover of law enforcement in Washington, D.C. is ramping up. The White House says federal agents and the National Guard will be on the streets 24/7 in an effort to curb crime. Residents have various perspectives on crime in the city, but many feel this is not the right approach, including Ryan Wong.
I think the idea that this is some state of emergency that we're living in, it's not how I feel, and I don't think it's how the people that we know here feel.
The FBI says its agents and partners made 45 arrests last night in D.C., mostly related to immigration, and more than a third for violent crime. Resident Alicia Cooper says she feels more safe with the federal oversight.
The positive is a sense of security. Residents, at the end of the day, they can feel secure that they know that there is a higher level of chain of command that is monitoring, you know, what's going on.
Pediatricians in Florida are concerned about low immunization rates among kindergartners. Carrie Sheridan from member station WUSF reports.
The CDC says for highly contagious diseases like measles, 95% of people need to be immunized to prevent outbreaks. Across Florida, only 7 out of 67 counties meet that threshold. Dr. Rana Alyssa leads the Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics.
It's very scary and worrisome because the worst is coming.
In Sarasota County, rates are among the lowest. Only 79% of incoming kindergartners are up to date on all their shots, according to the State Health Department. That's about the same level of immunization in areas of Texas, where a deadly outbreak of measles killed 2 children earlier this year. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Sheridan in Sarasota.
Stocks opened lower this morning as the Labor Department reported a sharp jump in prices at the wholesale level. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow fell about 104 points.
Wholesale prices in July were up 3.3% from a year ago. That's the sharpest increase in 5 months and significantly higher than forecasters had expected. Wholesale prices rose 0.9% between June and July. The increase comes as the Trump administration has imposed steep tariffs on imports from around the world. Some of those tariffs are climbing higher this month, so importers race to bring in goods before the higher taxes took effect. The Port of Los Angeles, which is a major gateway for imports from Asia, saw a record volume of cargo traffic in July. Asian stocks were mixed overnight, down in China.
Scott Horsley reporting. This is NPR. New polling shows a key voting bloc that helped re-elect President Trump is starting to back away from him and the Republican Party. NPR's Ashley Lopez reports the research finds a third of Latino voters who supported Trump don't plan on voting for Republicans next year.
Caitlin Jury with the Latino polling group Equis Research found that economic issues like persistently high prices on groceries and healthcare are driving Latinos shift away from Trump. But so far, she says, it hasn't translated into more support for Democrats.
To me, it's clear that neither party should assume that they have Latinos in their pocket one way or another.
Republicans have failed to deliver on a lot of their campaign promises, particularly around lowering the cost of living.
Jury said if Republicans want to keep gains among these voters, they need to deliver on those promises. And if Democrats want to take advantage of this opportunity, she says, they need to provide a sweeping economic vision ahead of next year's midterm elections. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
It's the first day of school for kids in Los Angeles. The superintendent of the L.A. Unified School District is urging immigration authorities not to conduct enforcement activity near schools right before and after the school day. Construction on a detention camp at Fort Bliss in Texas is moving ahead. Immigration officials expect to open the facility this weekend. It costs more than $1 billion to build, and it's expected to hold up to 5,000 adults as they await deportation. I'm Kristen Wright, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Tropical storm Erin is on track to become a hurricane by Friday and a major hurricane over the weekend. While current forecasts show Erin passing just north of the Leeward Islands, Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico, heavy rain, tropical storm force winds, and dangerous rip currents are still possible this weekend. The latest track has Erin eventually turning north and northeast away from the U.S., but how close it will get to the East Coast remains uncertain. Either way, the entire eastern seaboard is expected to see rough surf and a high risk of rip currents next week. And for Sullivan County, it's a timely reminder of the flooding risks that peak as hurricane season overlaps with late summer storms. Local officials, fire safety teams, and water rescue crews are already working to prepare for heavier rains and potential flooding. But when that alert pops up on your phone or social media feed, do you know what to do? At a recent Sullivan County legislative meeting, lawmakers and emergency services leaders stressed the need for updated safety plans, better public awareness, and personal preparedness, especially in high-risk areas of the county like Roscoe, Livingston Manor, Youngsville, Jeffersonville, Hortonville, and Calicoon. Radio Catskills Genevieve Hartnett spoke with John Hauschild, Deputy Commissioner of Public Safety and Fire Coordinator for Sullivan County, and Chief Nate Routledge of the Roscoe-Rockland Fire Department, about how alerts are issued, the environmental causes of floods, and how residents can be better prepared.
In the aftermath of the flooding along the Guadalupe River in Texas last month that killed over 100 people, state and local governments across the country looked inward to prepare for the risk of flash flooding in their state. New York was no exception. The areas of the state at the lowest sea level, including the major expressways into New York City, have seen devastating floods this summer. But even in the Catskill Mountains, flooding is a serious concern. The warming of the planet causes increased snow melt and runoff into the Delaware River and its tributaries, where they can then overflow when heavy rains come in the warmer months of the year. These risks were on the minds of legislators Brian McPhillips and Catherine Scott at the July 10th Sullivan County legislative meeting, the week after the Texas floods.
You know, based on some of the events down in Texas this, you know, past week, can we at least start the conversation to maybe have a roundtable with, you know, stakeholders, sheriff's department, fire, on some of these areas that were impacted in the past?
And I think people need to be prepared. We can have our first responders, you know what they're supposed to do, but people need to be prepared. People need to understand it's not just the rivers. If you live next to a cute little babbling brook, brook turns into a raging river.
Since that meeting in July, our region has seen countless flash flood warnings. And on July 31st, Governor Kathy Hochul even declared a state of emergency for all counties in downstate New York. This may have been a devastating summer for flooding in New York State, but the risks are even higher as we head into hurricane season and feel the impacts of it across the northeastern United States. I spoke with John Hauschild, Deputy Commissioner of Public Safety and Fire Coordinator for Sullivan County. He first explained the process of how local public safety agencies receive and respond to emergency weather warnings.
So the Division of Public Safety Emergency Management work hand in hand with the National Weather Service, State Emergency Management. We get alerts from National Weather. We get all kinds of warnings. And we also use here in Sullivan County, the New York Alert. We also use Everbright, all warnings for individuals. We get watches, warnings, and then when a disaster hits, we work very closely with the town highway departments, our county DPW, state partners. And we also, if it's really severe, we set up our emergency operations center here and coordinate all major activities. As far as if there's major power lines down, we work with the utility companies as well as highway departments, because a lot of times, not just here now with flooding, but in the winter when we get some quick thaws and major snowstorms, we have the highway departments can't plow the roads, can't do their work while down power lines, and the power line people can't do it because they can't get to them. So we have to work hand in hand. We have that excellent close relationship.
Hochschild emphasized that there are certain areas that face higher risk of flooding, including Roscoe Manor, Youngsville, Jeffersonville, Hortonville, and Calicoon. In response to the flooding in Texas in July, many were quick to identify cuts to the National Weather Service as one of the major reasons for the high number of fatalities. Hochschild is hesitant to cast blame, but also says that state and federal funding towards flooding prevention can make a big difference for rural counties.
One example is down in Kohlertown, part of Jeffersonville. They got a grant where they're able to do a lot of mitigation to help control flooding. And so far, it's been working. And I know down in Westbrookville, they got some money. Livingston Manor got some money, some federal money on these mitigation projects to help minimize the flooding. All cuts hurt, whether it's on the state level, federal level, local level. In emergency services, we're always trying to be prepared for no matter what situation arises. Like the commissioner said, with the governor's assets that are coming to each county will help us.
As Hochschild mentioned, Roscoe Manor is just one of many towns in Sullivan County that are at an increased risk of flooding. For more on this, I spoke with Chief Nate Routledge of the Roscoe Fire Department Water Safety Team.
I think it's increasing. Just in my time here, I've been here in this, in the fire department for 15 years, and it seems like we are experiencing those weather events more often. We're very familiar with it in Roscoe. Roscoe suffered some really major floods, some historical floods, notably back in 2006 and 2008, and one of those actually, unfortunately, ended in some fatalities as well. I don't know. That was a little before me, so I don't know how the notification process was then as far as from the state and the weather service and people like that, but it definitely seems like these weather events are becoming more regular.
Planning at the local level and funding towards flood mitigation can do a great deal to promote public safety, but Nate Routledge also emphasizes the importance of simply listening to the warnings given out carefully.
I think it does all come down to planning, and I think it can start right from the very top at the state level, but I think it also comes down to the individuals that are going to be affected. You know, listening to the warnings, not ignoring the warnings. In our experience, we've had floods even during my time here where we've gone door to door to give evacuation notices and tell people, like, we're here to get you out before it gets bad. And people will tell us that they'll flat out refuse to leave, whether it's they don't want to leave their homes, they don't want to leave their pets. They're not ready to leave. We've had that. Let me pack a bag real quick before I get in the boat and leave. And we've literally pulled up to people's front door in a boat to get them out. Like, it's that far into it. And the preparation, I think, just not ignoring those warnings. If we put a notification out or we come to your door and say, like, it's time to leave, let's go, or we're going to give you an hour, we're going to be there within the hour to remove you. I think that part of the planning and listening to those warnings could really make the biggest impact.
In addition to heeding the warnings put out through social media and on Amber Alert, both Routledge and Hochschild stressed the importance of attending New York State's citizen preparedness courses, which are held at the Sullivan County Emergency Services Training Center. Here's John Hochschild again.
So the citizen preparedness courses are offered to all our citizens here in Sullivan County. We've done some here at the Emergency Services Training Center for the public. They've been well attended. A lot of the senior citizen groups are doing, our civic organizations are doing them. It's through Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Services. And it's welcome to everybody to do. They come in, they do the program, and then they have what's called a bag program. You get a little backpack, and it's got some survival stuff in it. It's got like a water container. It's got a flashlight. It's got gloves. It's got a whole bunch of stuff, little first aid kit, and just to be prepared. And everybody should be prepared if a storm should hit with flooding or snow or whatever the emergency might be, to be prepared for at least 72 hours. Because you don't know, again, when the utilities could get out there and fix the problem or even get to it.
Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey are suing the Trump administration and FEMA for cutting grants to help with dam reduction and flooding mitigation. While New York State has not been a part of any similar lawsuits yet, Nate Routledge and his team at the Roscoe Fire Department are working to develop a new instant action plan at the local level to prepare against floods.
It's inevitable we will see another major flood in Roscoe. So we're developing a plan, and we're going to be reaching out to people for any information on any special requests. So do they have somebody that's a home oxygen or somebody that's handicapped and is non-ambulatory that maybe we need to prioritize those residents earlier in the operations rather than later on? So if there's anybody out there that has anything like that, they should communicate that to their local agencies, whether it's the fire department, the ambulance corps. So the advanced knowledge of that is going to be key.
In Liberty, I'm Genevieve Hartnett for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Woodstock beyond the stage. We'll take a tour through the Bindi Bazaar, the festival's hidden gem of crafts and creativity, now at Bethel Woods. This is Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. You may already know that Congress has ended federal funding to public media, but no matter what's happening in Washington now or in the future, this station's best bet is you. Making a donation, that's great. Making a monthly contribution, even better. Knowing we can rely on you helps in uncertain times. Take control of this station's future. Become a sustaining member today. Here's how.
Donate now at WJFFradio.org.
Donovan, Linda Thompson, Clive Gregson, and more next time on The Wagload Among Kids with me, Graham Rice, on Radio Catskill, as we explore songs about cars. There aren't many, but they're good. So join me, please, for Songs About Cars on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Tucked away to the east and west side of the 1969 Woodstock Festival site was a lesser-known but important part of the iconic weekend, the Bindi Bazaar. The Bindi Bazaar was a crafts bazaar for countercultural vendors, a place to unwind, and now it's an exhibit at the museum at Bethel Woods. As part of our Woodstock Week of Celebration, Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar had a bizarrely fun time visiting the museum at Bethel Woods' How Bizarre exhibit, and brings us this report.
When Woodstock organizers built the 1969 festival, they wanted to make sure attendees would never have to leave the site. People could have it all. Music, peace, food, and space to wind down from the bustle of the weekend. Enter what would soon be known as the Bindi Bazaar. Curator of exhibits at the museum at Bethel Woods, Julia Fell, said the bazaar was a marketplace and a trail system that connected nearly 500,000 attendees to the concert site and to each other.
At the time of Woodstock, it had trails running through it, and it had vendor booths set up along each trail. So in terms of the arts and crafts, there were a lot of vendors there selling handmade goods like leatherwork, beaded items, tie-dye, all sorts of things that you might associate with the counterculture.
This summer, a special exhibit called How Bizarre pays tribute to the campers, artisans, and the site itself of the Bindi Bazaar Marketplace.
And how many people were at Bindi Bazaar during the festival?
It's hard to say because it was sort of a transitory area. There were a lot of people going back and forth through the trails. So we know that there were about 450,000 people in attendance at the festival at its peak, which we consider to be about Saturday evening. So at any given time, there could have been hundreds or even hundreds of thousands of people going through the Bindi Bazaar. Some people did spend quite a bit of time there just because it was a little bit quieter, a little bit more removed from the huge crowd out on the festival field. So there were some people who actually spent most of their festival in the woods.
On one wall, a video projection of Bindi Bazaar organizers and attendees recall memories of building out the three major trail paths, the Gentle Path, the Groovy Way, and the Highway.
And we didn't know where to make the paths, so we noticed animal paths, follow the animal paths to make to guide us, basically.
It was obvious what direction, and then getting up here, it was obvious just find a place and make that your own, settle in. It wasn't crowded. I mean, we got here early enough that there were other people here, and they were setting up, or maybe already set up, but we weren't stacked in one on top of each other, which is what it turned out to be.
In another corner of the exhibit, a pack of Oscar Mayer beef bologna, a can of Vienna sausage, and a loaf of Big Daisy sliced white bread is inside a glass exhibit table. Phil says this section of How Bazaar highlights the archaeological work that the team has taken on in recent years to recover artifacts found at the Bindi Bazaar.
So what we're looking at right now is basically the remnants of somebody's camp and campfire. So what we think happened was a bunch of kids came to Woodstock. They brought a few bags of bread, they brought some margarine, they brought some bologna, kind of the stuff you would just grab if you were planning to make sandwiches for a few days. We got some soda bottles as well. And they used it all up, and when Woodstock was over, they piled it all into their fire pit that they had set up and buried it. And we only uncovered it about 54, 55 years later when we were doing some site development. So as soon as there was any indication that there is an archaeological feature, we were called out to the site and were able to recover these artifacts and preserve them and keep them safe before the development continued.
In another corner is a nod to the heart of Bindi Bazaar, the vendors. Underneath a simple canopy with a red rug is a replica of jeweler Ken Braze's vendor setup.
He's a vendor that was at Woodstock in 1969, and we reconnected with over the last couple of years, again, as part of our oral history initiative. So we were able to take Ken's oral history and get to know him a little bit, and he let us know that he still had the original molds of the jewelry that he produced and sold at Woodstock, and his display cases. These are also reproductions of his original display cases.
Wow.
And so we worked with Ken to reproduce the silver jewelry. So we have one set of all of the symbols that he had in his inventory in 1969 out on display in this space. They are also available for sale through our museum store.
And then what is the sign?
This is a reproduction of a sign that he had on display, again, in 1969. He went around to various different festivals. I believe he was at the Atlantic City Pop Festival a few weeks before Woodstock and had this sign out there. We believe he did also have it at Woodstock. So this is as close as we can get as a one-to-one representation of what his setup would have looked like.
And probably one of my favorite parts of the exhibit is behind a glass wall towards the back. Five mannequins dressed head to toe in original outfits worn at the 1969 festival.
We have, for example, this leather jacket was donated by Jerry Small, and he created that jacket himself. He was actually a leather craftsperson at the time. The jeans that are on that mannequin were donated by Stephen and Jennifer Brown, and they're just covered in these delightful, delightful patches. The smiley face bag was donated to our collection by Judith Kaufman. And I mean, that's just so cute, right?
What is so special about the exhibit is that most of the items were donated by actual Woodstock Festival attendees. Fell said the fact that so many people held on to these items decades later shows just how important this event was for so many.
Most people who are at Woodstock are around age 18. It's a really important part of a person's life right after finishing high school, maybe about to head off to college or perhaps to join the military even. You know, in 69, the war in Vietnam was going on, so that was weighing on people's minds of that age. So at 18 years old, say, you go to this crazy, incredible event, realize that maybe this is a significant event in American history as well as in your own life, and you say, you know, I'm going to hold on to that. I'm going to hold on to that item. I'm going to keep it in my closet, my drawer, my garage, wherever. and just hold on to it because it's a reminder of this like really pivotal moment.
You never know.
You never know. And maybe one day there will be a museum just for Woodstock.
Fell hopes the How Bizarre exhibit can help connect people today through moments, people, and places from the past.
I feel like there are always ways for modern day people to connect with people and events of the past. And sometimes what it takes is an artifact that you can relate to, whether it's a piece of clothing, it's a piece of audio equipment, it's a musical instrument, it's, you know, it could be anything that might hold significance in your life. And if you can realize that, oh, people in 1969 cared about this too, or people in 1969 thought this was a really cool thing to wear also, it just really helps tie the past and the present together.
The How Bizarre exhibit is open daily from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Museum of Bethel Woods. In Bethel, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
And our Woodstock Week coverage continues tomorrow. We'll go camping at the historic site of the 1969 Woodstock Festival. And you can hear all of our reports, including other information about Woodstock, on our podcast called Woodstock Lost and Found, uncovering the hidden and forgotten stories of the festival in Bethel, New York, through recovered audio, rare video, and in-depth interviews. We'll revisit the people, moments, and memories that shape this cultural landmark and explore some of the tales, the time almost left behind. All of the current stories you've heard this week are there, and we'll have more to come. And that's at WJFFradio.org. Click on the programming tab there at the top of the page, or shows tab, sorry, and then go to podcasts, and you'll find it there. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we're talking with trail volunteer Molly Rogers about the Lackawaxen River Trails, where you can hike, bike, paddle, and explore some of the most scenic spots in our region, and how you can help them keep it open and thriving. That's next on Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we've got two explosively delicious but lesser-known cuisines of the sun, the foods of El Salvador and of southern Thailand. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Lackawaxen River is a 31.3-mile-long tributary of the Delaware River in northeast Pennsylvania, and it's more than just a scenic stretch of water. It's the backbone of a growing network of trails and connecting communities, history, and outdoor recreation in our region. The Lackawaxen River Trails Group has been expanding access for walkers, hikers, bikers, and paddlers while promoting the unique character of this river corridor. Joining us now is trail volunteer Molly Rogers to talk about the newest trail openings, the spots worth exploring, and how the public can help keep this resource thriving. Hi, Molly.
Good morning.
Can you give us a quick overview of what the Lackawaxen River Trails Group is and what it is you guys do?
We are a small group. We basically plan and we partner with other entities. So we have worked with the state funders, the Department of Community and Economic Development that has a Greenways program, the Department of Community and Economic Development, and DCNR, the Department of Natural Resources, with getting grants. But we are not, up until recently, we weren't actually an entity. We are now officially a 501c3, but we had no official status when we got started. And we would partner with local counties and townships and boroughs who were the eligible entities to apply for the state funding. We're basically just like a group that helps connect people who want to invest in trails and the entities that want to put their money into trails because it's good for community development.
I mentioned that the Lackawaxen is a over 30-mile-long tributary of the Delaware River. What do you think makes the Lackawaxen area, such a unique place to explore?
My guess is it's a smaller river than the Delaware, and it's been overlooked for a really, really long time. If you drive along Route 6, which basically follows the river itself, but you barely see it. It's like it's in a different world. There are, if you get on the river, you realize all the places you pass, but when you're passing by the river, you almost never see it or notice it. So I think it's been unique in that it really has been ignored for as long as it's been ignored. I mean, at least it used to be a river where they would, it was an economic stream for canal boats and loggers. I mean, but that's, 100 years ago. So I think in the last several decades, it really hasn't gotten a lot of attention until recently.
And you're right. I mean, I've traveled along Route 6 there in the Wayne County area, and I don't really remember seeing it. Maybe there's a glimpse of it here or there. So unlike when you're traveling along Route 97 here in New York along the Delaware, when you see it kind of all along the way. Let's talk about some of the trails and like walking and hiking and biking and kayaking that are there that are hidden and overlooked. How can folks get to them and tell us a little bit more about them?
The two main centers at the moment, especially for the walking and the hiking, are in Hawley and in Honesdale. And we will be expanding out of that. Honesdale has a couple of really gentle trails. There's one in Apple Grove that's a nice, easy, short trail, and you can just sit by the river. But there's also the Irving Cliff Trail, and you can start down at the level of the borough and climb a fairly steep hill. But when you get to the top, you've got an amazing view, and it's just so fascinating to look down on Honesdale from the cliff. For anybody who knows it, it's where the star is for holidays and for Christmas. Mm-hmm. In Hawley, the very gentle trails, I mean, we've got there are trails in Bingham Park. There's a trail called Riverside Park. They're very gentle. They're very easy for all levels. But we've just opened the Gorge Trail, which is a little more challenging, but it connects in just over the bridge in Pike County.
And are there varying levels of trails, like some that are suitable for beginners up to experienced folks?
Absolutely. I think the Gorge Trail and the Irving Cliff Trail are a little more challenging, but they're not, I wouldn't say they're for experts. There's nothing in our system at the moment that's very, very challenging, but there is some altitude changing, and there are some steep sections of the trails, but I think most everything is accessible for almost anybody.
And there are some newer trails that have been introduced. Tell us about those.
The Gorge Trail is our newest trail. We just cut the ribbon a couple of weeks ago. But the really exciting thing about the Gorge Trail, I mean, it's absolutely a beautiful trail through the woods, but it connects. So for people who are familiar, there have been, for a number of years, trails along Lake Wallenpaupack. And then there have been trails in Hawley itself. There's a section, several sections of trail you can walk from Lock 31, which is Historical Society property, through the woods behind the Settlers Inn to Bingham Park and to Riverside Trail. The Gorge Trail connects the lake trails and the trails in Hawley. So for those who have enough time and enough interest, you can actually hike 7 miles from Lake Wallenpaupack down to Lock 31. And it's an amazing opportunity for people who really enjoy all of those different environments, from the lake, through the woods, through the town of Hawley, and to the Historical Society's property.
How can people get involved in supporting or maintaining the trails like you're doing?
We have a website, LackawaxenRiverTrails.org. And through that website, you can get our schedule of events. If we've got a big one coming up, I do want to mention before we finish up.
Yeah. What's that one? What's that big event?
It's the Lackawaxen River Sojourn, and it's scheduled for September 20th, and it's a day-long paddle from Hawley with a stop in White Mills, and then starting in Honesdale to White Mills to Hawley, and it's a great opportunity. You can, if you don't have a kayak or a canoe, you can get on the site and rent one. If you've got your own, you can just join in. There will be stops along the way and talks and food. So that's a great opportunity. That's September 20th. So you can get more information on LackawaxenRiverTrails.org. You can also go to that site to volunteer if you're willing to help maintain the trails. We're always looking for people just to walk and pick up things. To keep them clean, to keep them tidy, to warn us of things like downed trees. And you can also donate, because we're also always looking for matching funds when we apply for grants. And that comes from a lot of our private supporters.
And before we go, what are some of your favorite spots along the trails or the river that listeners should check out?
Right now, the Gorge Trail is my favorite, not just because it's the newest, but because I just think it's one of the prettiest. But I also love the Apple Grove Trail up in Honesdale, just because it's a really easy place to just park and spend. If you don't have a lot of time, you can just sit by the river, and it's sitting by the river, no matter what you're doing, is just relaxing and calming, and it's always just so peaceful. I would also, the last one I need to mention, if you're in a kayak or a canoe and you paddle from Honesdale down to White Mills, where there is a river access takeout, just before you get to White Mills, there is a section of the river that has a lot of eagle nests. Oh, and wow. You almost always see bald eagles just before you get to White Mills.
Always good to see the bald eagles and relax along the river. That's Molly Rogers, a volunteer with Lackawaxen River Trails, the multi-use trail system creating land, rail, and river trails from Honesdale to Lackawaxen in northeast Pennsylvania. More information at LackawaxenRiverTrails.org. Thank you so much, Molly.
Thank you for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk to the director of RED at Franklin Stage Company, bringing Mark Rothko's world to the stage. She speaks with culture reporter Valerie Manzi about what makes this story unforgettable next.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. At Franklin Stage Company this weekend and next, audience can step into the high-stakes, high-color world of legendary painter Mark Rothko. John Logan's Tony Award-winning play RED, set in the 1950s and based on real events, captures a pivotal moment in the abstract expressionist's career as he works on a major mural commission for the Four Seasons Restaurant in New York City. Alongside his new assistant, Ken, Rothko wrestles with big questions about art, integrity, and the seductions of fame. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi sat down with director Patricia Buckley to talk about bringing this intense two-character drama to life on stage.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill, Patricia Buckley. Thank you for having me.
You're back to talk about your final production at Franklin Stage up in Franklin, New York. That's running for the next 2 weekends. It opened last weekend, and it's a John Logan play that many of us are familiar with called Red, which is about the artist Marth Rothko during his commission to paint on the walls of Four Seasons Restaurant.
Yes.
And yes. What year was this?
He was working on that commission over a couple of years, several years, but the play is set in 1958.
It's a play about his relationship with his assistant and involves the theory of art in some way.
Yes, what I think the play is really talking about is a person in midlife who has reached a certain level of success and begins to, and is sort of at the pinnacle of what their success is, and then has a kind of crisis about whether that direction, which they have, a life they have created through what they have made and what the world expected of them, they begin to question whether that is the correct path, you know. And this is a very well-known psychological moment that Jung talked about a lot, when people would sort of have a crisis and the question of their authenticity meant sometimes moving in a different direction. You know, this is like the classic, in a way, midlife crisis, or, you know, should I be working at this job? Should I be in this marriage? Should I be, you know, living where I'm living? And obviously Marth Rothko, who had become very successful, has a lot built up, has a lot of sunk costs, so to speak, in the life he's made. And he hires this young man who becomes kind of an agent of the questions that bring about the crisis of whether doing this commission for a lot of money, for the Seagram's Corporation, was where he should be going. So there are a lot of discussions about art in the play and what does art mean. And Rothko has some memories and speaks about especially three pieces that influenced his life very deeply. And through those conversations and those memories and those arguments, he begins to make some decisions about where what he would like to do next and whether the commission is really the right thing for him to be doing. So it's really an exciting play of ideas.
And I love the opening line, what do you see?
Yes, there's a lot of talk in the play about what you see, because what you see determines what you make out of life. You know, it's almost the next question would be, and then what do you believe about what you see? And Ken, you know, comes to the job, and this play, the character comes, he's a messenger in a way, but he's also a wounded messenger because he's had some very difficult childhood things happen to him, which are a wound, but also a form of strength in a way, for him to be the guy who brings this message to Marth Rothko, who was, you know, kind of considered a giant of 20th century painting.
Yes, quite a giant, to be sure. There are so many people that make pilgrimages to a church down in, or a chapel down in Texas, mm-hmm. correct? Have you been to it?
I have not been to it. I've just seen a lot of the pictures. I did go to the National Gallery in D.C. and the Modern to see what I could see of his work when I started. I mean, I've always been a huge fan of his anyway. I love his paintings. But I did go and make my own little pilgrimage at the beginning of working on the play, because I wanted to refamiliarize myself with his work through the perspective of what John Logan's talking about in the play. But the photos I've seen of those paintings in the chapel in Houston are really monumental, almost black. You know, they're so dark. And he speaks about black, you know, in relation to red and what those things mean to him in the play.
And you are, for our audience, the director of the play.
Yes, I directed it.
And how was that experience for you?
It was good. It's always, you know, it's always challenging to do our plays on our schedule. We really have 2 weeks of rehearsal, and then we're right into tech, and that's about 3 days, and then we open. And so actors really have to come prepared. Most actors come to work at Franklin Stage off book, as we say, having learned all their lines. But of course, they have to get to know each other. A lot of times, this is why I like working with actors that I know, because that step is truncated. But of course, the two actors that are doing the play did not know each other, but I think they have really bonded. And, you know, I also had to do a lot of preparation before. There's not a lot of time to say, well, let's just see what happens. You know, you have to have a really strong idea of your staging and the way you want to work with music in the show and what you want your scenic elements to look like that the actors can work with, but that can also be prepared ahead of time. So we have quite a large easel. It's about 9 feet tall and about 8 feet wide, and it's on wheels, and that is kind of the central scenic piece in the play. I was lucky enough, our really wonderful designer Scott Holdridge built it for me before the rehearsals even started, and we could take it apart and put it back together. So we took it apart and put it in our third floor rehearsal space, so the actors could have it from day one and be working with it, because of course that's a big part of this play that you don't always see in plays, that I think is fascinating, is people at work. You know, you see them painting. You see them taking the paintings and the stretchers off the easel. You see Ken not only building a stretcher in one scene, but then finishing covering a stretcher in another scene. And so that can be really exciting, but you've got to be able to work with it early or it will be really hard for the actors to say their lines and do that stuff.
Well, there's a lot of work that goes into what we, the audience, see.
There's a lot more happening before opening night than, you know, what you see happening on stage.
And it's hard to remember sometimes. You know, it all seems so flawless and so easy.
Right. Well, that's the goal, right? You don't want the audience to have to work that hard.
Exactly.
Even though you have.
Well, yeah. We have to work hard mentally with something like this, which is challenging and wonderful.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think people have been really energized by it and found it exciting. I mean, there's also things in this play about young people versus old people coming into anything, you know, with an idea of what it should be, and then somebody young having an idea of something new. And there's a lot of echoes of fathers and sons in this play. I mean, there's just a lot to chew on, and in a good way, I think. I don't think the play, and there's a lot of humor in this play. You know, there's even more humor, I think, than I thought there was going to be. There's a lot of laughs, and the relationship between Roscoe and Ken, his assistant, grows and changes a lot by the last scene. And some of that is very funny, you know, some of the exchanges.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful endeavor to have taken, and that's coming up this weekend and next weekend. That's Thursday through Sunday, or Friday through Sunday?
Thursday through Sunday, and we have two shows on Saturday, a matinee at 3, and then our regular 7:30 evening show.
And the website is?
The website is www.franklinstagecompany.org.
Okay, well, thank you, Patricia.
Thank you, Valerie.
Thanks, Valerie Manzi. And now, before we go, on a Jeffersonville farm, fields of lavender and flowers aren't just pretty, they're part of a 500-year-old Japanese art form called ikebana. Farm and Country's Kimberly Izar takes us inside the blooms and the magic of summer in full flower with Kaya Abe-McGee, founder of Momo Global Flowers.
It's a hot, clear-skied day in late July, and Lysianthus flowers of various colors line an open field. Tucked in a back road in Jeffersonville, New York, Kaya Abe-McGee tells me about what makes Lysianthus flowers so special to her. These large flowers are similar to roses, but they're extremely popular in McGee's home country, Japan.
And when you import from Japan, it's very expensive. Mm. So lots of flower farmers recently decided to grow lysianthus. So these are the types of lysianthus, purple, light purple, green, yellow, pink is coming, and all slightly different. Some of them have lots of petals and looks like a rose, and it stays quite well in a vase.
McGee's 20-acre farm is neatly lined with deep purple and fuchsia pink flowers at different blooming stages, some nearly fully open to some just starting to reveal its petals. She specializes in a Japanese art form of arranging flowers called ikebana, which uses select blooms to express a feeling or emotion.
How did you learn to develop this kind of special kind of arrangement?
Okay. The ikebana itself is 500 years old history, and it started off in Kyoto in Japan. So by that time, I think they started with altar flower, very simple altar flower for both sides, one stem, and then little by little developed with a tea ceremony. And it was a male practice. Mm. Not woman was allowed to do so. So it was a higher class people who just do ikebana and tea ceremony, prince and princess. So in 70s, 80s, become a very big movement in Japan that all the housewife, before they go to get married, they have to, not have to, but it will be nice to know how to do the tea, how to make the tea, and do the flower arrangement. So they started off one type of school, but now there's 2,000 or 3,000 people, different kind of school.
In Japan.
Yes.
That's so many.
It is. So maybe 16 years ago, when I closed my jewelry shop in New Jersey, I always liked flowers and decided to do practice flower arrangement.
McGee says she's been studying the Japanese art of ikebana for a long time.
I study for probably 16 years. And still, I am a master of ikebana, but it's a lifetime commitment that it never stops. It's like tea ceremony. You just have to keep on practicing like exercise. You just have to be better and better. So I go.
But
to-
running a biodynamic farm, that's still relatively new to McGee. It all started during the COVID pandemic. Like many in 2020, she was anxious to spend more time outdoors, so she headed to Long Island, where a friend of hers needed some help on her farm.
And didn't know anything about biodynamic, and when we have the lunch together, the salad was amazing. And it's, what is this biodynamic? So Ira, the owner of the farm, explained me biodynamic is a method that they have a calendar each year, and the moon and the sun, and when to plant, what to plant. You use only compost. If you don't have any animals, you can use for surrounded area. I think it's 100 miles, but closer as better. And I think quarter of your land have to be compost, and keep on making the compost, and no pesticides, nothing. But it's a very slow process. Mm. If you put any material to add on to boost up or kill the bugs, it's easier, but it takes a long time. And I'm still learning each year, because I am ikebana artist. I decided to be a flower farm.
Now, Momo Global Flowers is a hub in the heart of the Catskills for ikebana flower workshops, music, and outdoor events. She has all kinds of flowers in bloom, from lysianthus to Casablanca lilies. She even has an expansive vegetable garden tucked away.
Some tomatoes are celery for us to eat. Sweet peas, pepper, cherry. It's growing at the moment. Marigold, tomatoes.
Oh, I love marigolds.
So marigold and tomatoes, they go together. They are, it's a companion plant.
Not every day brings perfect weather conditions, like the day that I visited Momo Global. McGee says that more rainfall has delayed her operations this past summer.
Because of the rain this year, probably six or seven weeks of rain, and in between there was only one or two clear day, and this area is clay soil, and that's not enough to plant. So I'm delay, but now it's flowering and more to plant because we are delay digging to make the rows like this. But some of them we planted, and it's coming up slowly but surely. Here we are making the bed, raised bed, and we're putting the hay that it's actually my hay that I cultivated last year. And also down there is very wet, so I decided to do willow trees. So there's a couple of different type of willows, and some of them can use for the basket too, weave the basket.
And like most farmers, McGee still deals with critters and fluffy creatures trying to nibble on their hard work.
And unfortunately, we have a rabbit eating all my dahlias.
No.
So it's not coming up as I wanted. So if you can see, they particular like some of the type kind that maybe it's a better salad for them, that some of them stays okay, but some of them, you can see the patches that they've been eating, so they are. I have to replant something else in between.
Oh, wow.
So what can I do? I did the fence. I have a deer fence, but also I have a wire fence underneath, chicken wire fence, if you can see here. But somehow the rabbits have a fluffy body, but they can squeeze in somewhere, from somewhere.
So they're sneaking in somehow.
So I read that maybe I can plant the onion around it. So
there,
yes, onion. So I'm going, if I have a chance, I'm going to protect some of the area.
Do the green onions kind of protect the beds and keep the rabbits away?
That's what I read, so I'm going to try it.
We'll try it.
I don't want to spray anything or anything, but if they are hungry, they will eat.
Yeah.
So I'm feeding the rabbits at the moment.
For McGee, always learning is just part of the joy in being a farmer.
Every year, it's getting better, but it's slow. Once you make a mistake one season, you cannot fix most of the things on that season. You have to think next season. But I enjoy it. I like to be in the air. The people around here, I met so many nice people, local people. Some people came from New York City. Great community, slow, no hustle. You just have to work every day, sun or shine, on the field.
Mobile Global Farms will host a Shinrin-yoku concert and market on Saturday, September 6th at their farm. That's at 414 Swiss Hill Road in Jeffersonville, New York. It'll feature musicians, artist workshops, and Asian food vendors from Korean to Japanese to Filipino food. In Jeffersonville, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
And thanks, Kimberly, for that. And I look forward to the new episode of Farm and Country this Saturday at 10. Kimberly will bring you a report on the Delaware Highlands Pollinator Pathway event and also a Farmer's Market Favorites for your summer smoothie segment with Eugene Thalman of Sprouting Dreams Farm and a Star Talk with Keith Hubbard. That's Farming Country Saturday at 10 on Radio Catskill. That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, a conversation with Late Show with Stephen Colbert comedy writer Felipe Torres Medina about his new book.
For me, as a comedian, there is an element of having to face the horrors with humor because it's the only way we can endure it.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. It's Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, sunny to partly cloudy, a stray shower or thunderstorm is possible with a high of 83. Tonight, a low of 61. Tomorrow, mainly sunny, maybe a few clouds around, a high of 82. And looking ahead to the weekend, a chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon both days with highs in the mid to low 80s. Low to mid 80s. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.